Soundwaves Tape Ministry Queensland. It's now Monday afternoon, the 23rd of May 1988, and we're at the Barden Professional Centre for a conference on church discipleship, a pastor's conference. It's now into the afternoon session, and the theme or the subject under consideration is the cost of leadership, and the guest speaker is Jim George. This lecture was given in the theater. Cassette number T4.
Buffet my body and make it my slave, lest possibly after preaching to others, I myself should be disqualified. And so we see that this sacrifice has got to be one of physical sacrifice. And that we must be ready to sacrifice in the area of physical. Sleep. Sleepless nights. Just like, you know, it's not that big a deal, but flying in yesterday afternoon, you know, and being 30 hours in the air or in some airport someplace, and then getting up and preaching last night and then getting up and being here today, this is all a part of the price that all of us play. We're no different than you men. That there are times when you spend a lot of sleepless nights. Somebody calls you up on the phone at night and they got a problem. They need help. And they can't wait till in the morning or whatever it is. Or somebody dies and you rush over to their home to give them consolation. Give that family consolation. So there's a tremendous sacrifice when it comes in the physical area. There's also a mental sacrifice. There's physical sacrifice, then there's mental sacrifice. 2 Timothy 3:16. Study to show yourselves approved as a workman who does not need rightly divided. Your work to study the Scriptures, to spend the... You know, and things that we see as fellowship, as some of our... Now, obviously, your associate... theirs is a mental quality in the sense that they are the job that God has asked with our lay elders, that all of us together, team, are to be growing and developing and maturing as a team. And our elder board is only as strong as our weakest man. And if we're not all growing together, then we're being held back as a team of men. And so there have been many occasions, I say many, numerous occasions where we have asked the men not to continue on with us because they have not continued to grow mentally, to grow in their understanding of Scripture. See, they weren't disqualified spiritually. They didn't fall into some horrible sin. It's just they weren't continuing to grow in their understanding and maturity of the Word of God. And I think a lot of us can think of churches maybe we've been in the past where you've got a group of leaders that are stagnant, that they haven't grown in years, and therefore the level of the maturity of your church is stagnated as well. And so there is that sacrifice that we need to make as leaders. We need to be growing so that our congregations will continue to grow. Well, we'll talk about that in a minute. A spiritual, I've got a physical sacrifice, a mental sacrifice, and a spiritual sacrifice. Okay, I'm saying from a knowledge or a maturity standpoint, not from the moral standpoint, but more of an understanding, a maturity in the Word of God, that we have disqualified men who are no longer on our leadership team because they have not continued to keep pace with the growth of our church. You know, your churches are growing. And they're growing at the rate that you as leaders are growing. The faster you grow, the faster your churches will grow in their maturity. Well, no, I'd say gifts and the proper ministry of those gifts and development of those gifts. It doesn't mean that you're all going to school or seminary, but that all of us as leaders are continuing to grow in our understanding of the Word of God. Okay? And we've had a number of men over the years, as I said, who have been disqualified because they have stopped growing and they've hindered the growth of our board as a whole and the growth of our church because they, again, we are a reflection and a direction for the church. And if we're not growing, then our church is not growing. Well, you know, it's one of those things where we talk about educating your voters. And unfortunately, what you have in many cases is the most immature people in your church running the church, right? They find out that you're getting ready to have a business meeting and they got this big issue coming up. And Maud gets on the phone and tells all of her old cronies, "Hey, listen, they're about to pull the wool over our eyes over here. You better get over here on Wednesday night." And so she gets all of her group out there, and as a block, they vote against something. And here you as a group of leaders, you as a group of deacons, or whatever you call yourself, have worked so hard to develop some direction for your church, and then you got a group of carnal Christians over here in the corner that are keeping this thing from moving out the way God would want it to grow. And obviously this is an issue and an area that you got to work with. You got to live with it. And we're not trying to overthrow any system that anybody has. All we're saying is there's a possibility of an easier way of doing it. And we would say, it appears somewhat biblical in its approach. Now, let me say this. If everybody in your church was growing and mature, then this would be a fine way of going about it. If everybody in your congregation were they spirit-led, spirit-controlled, maturing, growing, dynamic Christians, you get together as a group and decide as a group, as a priesthood of believers, that this is a direction that God is leading us. Unfortunately, it doesn't work that way. And it's so difficult for people to, at any level, to be growing, but more so at that level. And why it's even at the level of a group of men, 5, 10, 15, however many you've got, even for them to be growing. But that's the challenge that we have. We set the pace, the spiritual pace for our church. Those of you that have run races, that sort of thing, you know, you've got a guy that sets the pace for the rest of the pack. And so we as the leaders set the pace for spiritual growth by the pace that we set. See this? Probably not, but the issue is not getting there, it's staying there. All right? What we're saying is we've got people who got there because of their maturity, but we're asking them to stay there because of their maturity, because of their growth. So we're saying none of us have arrived yet. We're all growing and maturing. And so therefore, when you come on the board, you realize that it is a process that you will continue to be a part of in your own life. And this is probably a process where a guy could stop growing today and you wouldn't recognize it for several years. But ultimately, it catches up with us. Be sure your sins will find you out, that kind of a thing. One of these days, we all wake up and Joe, who was with us, who we thought was still with us, is back there someplace. And he hasn't kept up, right? And he's kept falling further and further back. You know, it's a very subtle thing over a period of time. And so that's what I'm saying, the sacrifice that it demands, that it's a constant growth. You know, it's the old saying, here lies, you know, the tombstone of the preacher. Here lies Brother Reverend so-and-so, you know, died 1988. Let's see, how does that go? Died in 1960. was buried in 1988. Right? It's the idea that a lot of men, when they go get out of seminary, it's as if that is the end itself, not realizing that is only the means towards an end. That's only the beginning. And being on our elder board is only the beginning. It's not the end. And they need to realize that when they come on because of the sacrifice we're asking them to make. Physically, because of the time and effort, the average elder puts in probably 10 to 15 extra hours a week. You know, involvement. Ron Hendrickson, who spoke to you this morning, I think, right? And will be speaking again tomorrow and other times. When he was the chairman of the board, he probably put in 20 to 30 hours, maybe even 40 hours a week at the church as chairman of the board. The year that he was on the board. I mean, as the chairman. And the issue with that is that at the end of that time, and I think this is true, and I ought to check this before I say it, but I think that he was awarded the top salesman in his insurance company at the end of that time. Isn't that amazing? How he put God first. As an insurance man, your sales are a result of your efforts, aren't they? The more effort you put in, the more sales you make. Well, in this case, by putting God first, at the end of that time, God rewarded him by making him the top salesman. And so I think that's the kind of priorities that we're looking for with the men who come on the board. Seeing that, you know, yes, they have jobs and they have responsibilities in the secular world, but that they're willing to not be preoccupied with those things in order to serve God. Okay, so physical sacrifice, the mental sacrifice, and you've got to encourage all of your leaders of this, that there is some sacrifice involved. And maybe this is the kind of thing that you lay out to them every year before, when you have nominations and you have the voting from the floor, you know, in your business meetings. You say, okay, so-and-so has been nominated for these people have been nominated for these positions. We're not going to vote on these positions for a week because I want to instruct the nominees as to their responsibilities. And so you set down every year the sacrifices that are going to be needed for them to be properly installed in this place. You know, I think it's horrid to have those kinds of elections. You know, some guy, he walks in, staggers in, you know, into a business meeting. Maybe, you know, I guess he's probably a member, right? He staggers in and he's the only one available, and say, well, let's let Joe do it. And then there's this mad rush to elect Joe. He's never even thought or prayed about it, and all of a sudden he's the chairman of some group or some committee. So maybe we ought to say, well, Joe's been nominated. Let me sit down with Joe this week and let him help him to understand what's involved in this position. Then we'll have a vote on that next month or next week or whatever. Okay, because there is a sacrifice. And then finally, the third element is the spiritual sacrifice, 1 Timothy 3 and Titus 1, that we talked a little bit about this last year, the qualifications for your godly leaders, and not lowering the standard, but raising it. And that's why we must, as leaders, understand what those qualifications are and help our men to know what those qualifications are. We had a group in last week. We have what we call local church leadership conferences, where a group of men, one single church will bring their leadership in and spend the day with us. Spend all day and into the evening. And we have seminars and lectures and workshops on different aspects of leadership. But we started talking about some of these issues, spiritual issues, in 1 Timothy 3 and Titus 1. And I mean, they hit the ceiling. They started reacting to everything I said. And I said, wait a minute. How much have you studied on it? Well, no, but that sounds pretty tough to me, you know. And their emotions started dictating what they understood Scripture to be. All right? And one of the guys that we were talking about, having children who believe. And, I mean, this guy hit the ceiling. And come to find out, he had some unbelieving children. It's amazing how our theology is determined by our circumstance at times, isn't it? But see, that's the kind of things that we have to deal with. And you need to wrestle with, you and your church, in these areas. And so therefore, there is a spiritual sacrifice. And so therefore, because of that, not all men will qualify in your church to be leadership, because of the sacrifice that it's going to take. And not all men are willing to sacrifice spiritually in those areas. And you need to understand, and your board needs to understand what those are. Okay? So, that's done. No. We look at the spiritual qualifications, the functional qualifications, particularly like an elder, that of the shepherding function, the teaching function, what's the other? There's shepherding, teaching, overseeing, or administration function. So we see three elements involved, and we evaluate a man's abilities based on his functional abilities as well as his moral qualifications and giftedness. Yeah. Yeah.
For instance, I would expect that he would pray for his teachers every day. And I don't get that without writing it out and sharing it with the person prior to their accepting the office.
Yeah. Sure. And I think that's obviously needed. Well, actually what we do is we, particularly at the elder level, we don't give them a job description as such, you know, in... It's understood. We go through it with them, and we have what we call an elder training period or program, where we have a year of they become elders in training. And so over that year, we give them, you know, they get an understanding of what's required and responsible. No. Yeah, right. And probably we should have something like that, because obviously... if we know what the goal is, you know, a direction, then we're more likely to reach it, right? But I think that's a good point for all of us in working with our leadership at any level. They need to know what's expected of them. Right.
You and somebody else will count it, and you'll record it and sign for it, but it was never written down. And I started to see that becomes very necessary, and
sure,
that kind of protection and what is expected in writing. I just,
sure. Yeah. I'm sure we do at certain levels in the church, and yeah, but not as a general rule. I guess when you've got 400 deacons. Yeah. Yeah. But I think it is, obviously, I think we need to have something like that. Another element is that it will be lonely. Second Timothy. And for anybody to say that the ministry is not lonely, I think probably doesn't really understand. I know John has talked about this often. He says, you are aware of the fact, let's see, 2 Timothy 1:15, that all who are in Asia turned away from me, among whom are Phygellus and Hermogenes. And then he goes on in 4:11 and says, only Luke is with me. Pick up Mark and bring him with you, for he is useful to me for service. So Paul, in a sense, had a situation where He was often alone. He had people around him in many cases, but still yet he was alone. It is a lonely business that we're involved in. One of the youth teachers, or one of the men who's involved in training up youth men out at the college, said, "I'd rather be right than popular." With a statement like that, you automatically set yourself apart from the masses. "I'd rather be right than popular." This is what he tells the kids. And I think that we find this as well in the ministry, that as you grow in your responsibility as a leader, that there are fewer and fewer people that you can confide in. Because, for one, they can't handle it. You know, you got issues in the church and you can't say, "Well, I need to tell you about so-and-so." You know, he can't handle it. And anyway, you shouldn't be talking to him probably anyway. So who do you talk to? Well, very seldom you have no one to talk to. You go home and tell your wife, and it destroys her as well. You know, there are a lot of things that I can't tell my wife. It's not that I keep secrets, but there are certain things that I feel that she doesn't need to know. There's no reason why she needs to know those things. For her protection, getting back the protection of that individual. And so it becomes a very lonely thing. Maybe you have a brother that you can call over the phone and talk to. Somebody in another state, another city, you know, that doesn't know your situation, or they don't know him. So you can talk about some of the people in your church and, "Well, what do I do about this guy and this guy?" This is what I'm saying. This guy that calls me every Monday morning from Atlanta, Georgia. See, he doesn't have anybody else to talk to. And so he calls me. And so the phone rings every Monday morning. I said, "It must be Monday." He said, "Yep, it's Monday." Yeah. Yeah. He's got an 800 number. It's a toll-free. Yeah. But I have gotten calls from overseas before. People saying, "Hey, you know, I hate to bother you, but, you know, didn't have anybody else I could talk to." I'm a great listener, so if you want to call me, go ahead. If you can figure out the time difference. Okay. 1 Peter 1:15 says, "But like the Holy One who called you, be holy yourselves also in all your behavior." The word holy means to be set apart. See, as we provide that holy life and that holy example, that in turn is going to set us apart. We're not going to be doing all the things that everybody around us does. And so it's going to be lonely. Probably the loneliest man in the world is someone like, well, say like the President of the United States. Probably one of the loneliest men. And probably even more lonely is a pastor, in the sense that in many cases he doesn't have all of those people that he can confide in and then writes his speeches and makes excuses for him and all of these things. I mean, he's on his own. And so a pastor probably is even more alone in that sense. Yeah? That's true. They have no one to talk to in many cases, and particularly if they may be the only Christian in a school. Right? The only Christian in a secular school. And that gets to be pretty lonely. A lot of pressure on them. A close scrutiny of Bible characters who God richly blessed and used were men of solitude. Okay? Part of it is the fact that they were ostracized by others, but also for the fact that they themselves went away and were in seclusion at times. It's very difficult to be all that you can be in public without a private life, a private ministry. And so we realize that it will be lonely. Decisions will set you apart. People will not like your decisions and will separate themselves from you. So your decisions you make will be something that sets you apart. What about Jesus in John chapter 6? It wasn't a decision as much of a statement as he said, that you must eat my flesh and drink my blood. And what did it say? It says that they all departed because it was a hard saying. They didn't understand what he was saying, and so they left. They were alienated from him. And so I think we see that a lot of decisions, a lot of the statements that we make will alienate people. There are many decisions that you will not be able to share with anybody, not even your wife. And yet we have, in Matthew 28:19-20, Jesus says, "And lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the age." Even though there's very few people around us, we still have the Lord, don't we? We still have that fellowship with the Lord. And I think that's why we need to cultivate that personal life. I'd have to say, and maybe I'm wrong in this, guys, and maybe you'll want to rebuke me or counsel me otherwise, but I have found that I get my sufficiency from the Lord. I don't need a lot of outside help because I've determined to trust God and to allow God to be my support. And so the time that I have in the Word, the study and prayer, I don't have this feeling of a void because I don't have a lot of friends and a lot of people I can share these things with. And maybe that's abnormal, I don't know. But I'm just saying that because I've seen this over the years, I have developed that relationship with the Lord where I don't need that outside relationship. Now, I'm not talking about my wife and that relationship. I'm just talking about from a ministerial standpoint. Yes. Yeah. Right. Yeah, and maybe hers is even more difficult, and I think that's why you need to help her develop that inner life with her Lord. So that a lot of times when you're not around, and it gets really difficult as the children grow up and she's left alone. Those of us whose wives are getting to the point where the children are now to the age where they're kind of leaving the nest, it's a very critical time for us guys with our wives. Because she no longer has those children to kind of divert her attentions when you're not around. And so if she doesn't have the right relationship with God, you know, it can be a very difficult time when you're not around. And we're not around a lot of the times because of the ministry. You may be right. I know my wife definitely appreciates some affirmation from me on a regular basis. You know, I don't necessarily need it from others. It's nice to have, and you guys are welcome to come and tell me what a great guy I am. I know my wife, she really needs encouragement quite a bit. She gets depressed and down again because of this issue of people not understanding her for her particular gifts and abilities. She's a very contemplative kind of person with a gift of discernment. And that really makes it a difficult time because she sees through people, the phoniness of people, and she also has a gift of encouragement, which also holds people accountable. And so she confronts people on their phoniness. And it's amazing, you know, how people respond to that, you know. When you tell them that there are some areas that they need to deal with in their life, they somewhat react, mostly negative, you know, rather than seeing that as help. So she doesn't have a lot of friends for that reason either. Well, besides that, a lot of times they won't actually even criticize her face, but they'll tell somebody else who they know will in turn tell your wife, and so it's about third hand that she gets it, you know, and there you are, oblivious to it, and she says, "Now, should I tell him? I don't want to, you know, discourage him or all that." So she's stewing around with all of this information that she doesn't know whether to share with you or keep it to herself as well. And so you're right. The lot of a pastor's wife, in many ways, may be more difficult than the pastor's lot. That's
quite frankly, if anybody does that to my wife and I find out about it, it'll be the last time they ever do it.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate what you're saying, and I think that we all understand the spirit of that. But there wouldn't be many people left because we're criticized constantly. And that's true. You know, that's one of the reasons why at the seminary that I'm involved in, the Master Seminary, we have a 3-year program for the wives. A set curriculum that they go through on a weekly basis. They meet together for 3 hours once a week and go through this set curriculum. Well, yes it is and no it isn't. My wife just finished it and she's road testing it this week. She and Pat MacArthur are doing a conference together up in Seattle. And so, if you're interested in that, when we leave, just put a little note on a piece of paper and I'll send some over. And you can get those through Graham in Sydney. But it's a 3-year program of helping to prepare the wives to be pastors' wives. Because what happens is, guys go through seminary or Bible school and nothing is ever done with the wife. Exactly. And I read a story, I read a report the other day, and it was shocking that the majority of men who leave the ministry, it's not because of their own abilities, but because their wives couldn't handle the ministry. See, we prepare the men for the ministry, but we never prepare their wives to be a part of the ministry. Not to do the ministry, but just to be a part of His ministry in that local church. But this is a good point. We probably ought to put something in here in our curriculum, or, you know, maybe next year. Next year we'll have something in here. We'll be handing those out. We'll have a whole section of the pastor and his wife dealing. We're going to do marriage and family and youth ministries. Well, give me the sheet and say you want the pastors. Yeah, we have it. It's done, but it just has not been reprinted, so we can send you a copy of that. I think there's an expectation level that pastors feel from the congregation. And so whether they are or not, they try to live up to that expectation. Right? Rather than being themselves. We talked about being yourself as a discipler. You know, I think we need to understand who we are as a person and accept that and then ask that the congregation accept us for who we are. Now, obviously not our sin. And we can't just be a slob, you know, and say, "Well, I'm this is who I am. You gotta take me for who I am." But obviously trying to grow and develop as men of God, but not try to be something more than who we are. And I think, and this is a part of the whole training for the women, is to help them not to feel expectations that are not there for some cases, or to help the congregation understand them as who they are, and they have spiritual gifts, and they may or may not use those gifts depending on their needs at home, if they got young children and that sort of thing, and not for the congregation not to necessarily expect them to be like the last pastor's wife who headed up everything. I mean, she was in charge of everything, and yet she was 40 years older than your wife, you know, and her children were gone, and she had all that maturity, and they expect your wife to be the same thing. Sure. And I think, you know, you've got to be able to do it in a discreet manner, in a manner that the people would handle it. You know, if you got up there every Sunday and shared your dirty linen and the laundry of your life, it wouldn't be long before the confidence level definitely would be. But sometimes, like, you know, boy, you know, several months ago, I don't know whether you all realized it or not, but I was really struggling with some issues in my life, you know? And then say, maybe share a little bit of that and say how God had given you the victory in that. And somebody says, well, Pastor, how come you didn't let us know? And maybe you should have, you know? But it's good to, at times, particularly when you're able to gain the victory, to go back and share with them that, yes, you struggled in some of those areas, and this is how God gave you the victory in that area.
Yeah.
And I think, see, that's what I don't see a lot in particularly other countries. I see that either the role of the pastor is so exalted, either by the pastors themselves or by the laity, that he is seen as something bigger than life, some super saint in some other category than the rest of his people, and including his leaders. But what I have seen that in certain places, maybe here, these are exceptions, but even in America where the men have developed a relationship, the pastors that have developed a relationship with their board to where they're seen as a team, and that he is maybe a leader among leaders. All right, obviously the pastor is going to have some abilities that go beyond his other leadership, but he doesn't go beyond that. In the sense of he doesn't go so far ahead of them people that they're not a part of the decision making and the shared leadership. And that's what Jay will talk about, this whole area of shared leadership. And he's great at that. In his last church and Grace Church, and then now in his new church, you know, it's like what he did. He came in the first week he was there. He took everybody away on a retreat first of all, he had the staff that they went out for a couple of days. Then he had another group of people out for a couple of days. And then he finally had another group. In other words, so he had all of his leadership for a couple of days just to let them share where they see the church needs to be going and all of that. And he says it bought him at least 6 months' time right there. Because from the very beginning, they saw him as a part of them, a part of a team, rather than barking orders, walking in and saying, okay, this is what we're going to do, you do this and you do that and you do that. So I think you'll really appreciate Jay's ministry to you all. Okay, we may never get through these, I'm not sure. You're probably already feeling this one. It'll be tiresome. Oh, you say, well, has that guy ever shut up? Again, 2 Corinthians 11, where Paul says that the fatigue factor, have you ever been just so fatigued. I have been in labor and hardship through many sleepless nights in hunger and thirst, often without food and cold and exposure. So, Sanders, have any of you read Spiritual Leadership by J. Oswald Sanders? Incredible book. If you don't read that at least once a year, then you're probably, well, you're out of the will of God, that's for sure. I can say that for sure. I challenge you to do that, to put that as a part of your annual reading program. But he says, if he is unwilling to pay the price of fatigue for his leadership, it will always be mediocre. It's been said, I'd rather burn out for God than rust out for the devil. Someone has said that the world is run by tired men. You know, I think of, I look back at our doctors back on the back row there. They've got a whole cheering section back there. And I remember when I used to call on physicians, and particularly the interns and the residents at the teaching hospitals. You know, those guys were, you know, walking zombies most of the time because of the hours that they put in. And, you know, most doctors put in a lot of hours, and they're always tired. And yet they've got to be able to perform, you know, to the letter. You know, you'd be hard-pressed for a surgeon to go in there and fall asleep while he's on the job. But it's going to be tiresome. There must be a balance. Pace yourself. The Christian life is not a sprint race, but a long-distance race. And so realize that there are going to be times when you're tired. And this is why I think it's good to be able to get away. And I don't know if you all do that. Those of you, or all of you, I think, should do it, because I think all of you are busy people, whether you're full-time in the ministry or not. But my wife and I try to get away on a regular basis, just to refresh our marriage, to keep that old pizzazz there, and just to kind of get reacquainted in many ways. I mean, you can get so out of touch with each other, kind of buzzing in and out, doing different things, you going this way, she going that way. And I think it's really important that we have these times that we get away with our wives. And maybe even, and I haven't done this a lot, I've been thinking about it, but there have been those that advocate that maybe once a month that we get away alone ourselves, just be with the Lord for a day, to pray, to meditate, just to contemplate, just to give some thought to the direction of our life and ministry on a regular basis, and to refresh ourselves. So that's something to consider, just to take away some of that tiredness that comes from just the mental exhaustion. They say that to preach the average sermon on a Sunday morning is the equivalent of an 8-hour job of digging a ditch. That you come away from that and, you know, you're just wrung out physically. Emotionally, it takes so much out of you. And that's why I'm constantly amazed at John MacArthur. He preaches 2 45-minute services. Sermons on Sunday morning. He'll come back and preach a 45-minute service, 45-minute sermon in the evening, and then he's up at and teaches a class out at the college at 7:30 in the morning, and then prays with the staff at the college, and he just goes on and on. Now, he does spend a lot of time with his wife, particularly he has his evenings. He has a little bit different schedule than you and I would have in the regular ministry. So he's got all of us around to do all of that other stuff, so he can focus in on his preaching and teaching. But I think that it exacts a great toll on us spiritually in the area of preparing for lessons, that because of the work that's involved. And that's why I think a lot of pastors don't do a lot of that, because it is so exhausting. They're not willing to pay the price that it's going to take to do that. I wonder why I needed so much sleep, of which I don't get. You know, I don't have any problem until I sit down. If I can just keep moving, I'm all right. It's just so embarrassing. I always set up my counseling in the afternoon. You know, that's kind of a lull time. And it's so embarrassing to sit there and fall asleep in front of the counselee. It really shows you're really interested in their life. You know, they're pouring your heart out to them and you fall off your chair. It will involve criticism. 2 Corinthians 10:10, where he says, for they say, see, this is criticizing. They're criticizing Paul. His letters are weighty and strong, but his personal presence is unimpressive and his speech contemptible. You know, you're criticizing Paul for his ministry. You know, hey, you know, this guy, his speech is unimpressive. His, you know, the whole thing. He's got these letters that really are strong. And so this was all criticism that they were labeling against the Apostle Paul. In his absence, of which it always is, nobody will ever criticize you to your face or come and admonish you to your face. They always do it behind your back. I guess that's the nature of it. If you cannot stand criticism, you will never make it as a leader. Every leader can expect some criticism at different times, maybe all the time. No leader is exempt from criticism. And his humility will nowhere be seen more clearly than in the manner in which he accepts and reacts to criticism. That's the key. No leader is exempt from criticism, and his humility will nowhere be seen more clearly, than in the manner in which he accepts and reacts or responds to that criticism. The greater our humility, the better we will respond or react to criticism. You know, the greatest, most humble man on earth said nothing when he was criticized at the trial, his own trial, right? And so that is a good indication of humility, because what happens when somebody criticizes us and it's not true? Well, particularly our pride may set in and say, well, wait a minute, that's not me. You know, you're impugning my character and all of this. When in many cases, our best response is no response. But I need to clear this up. Well, if it's not true, then do we need to say anything? This has been a great example to me that during this whole issue that John has faced with some of the fighting fundies in America and all of the things that they're saying, all of this just outright lies. I mean, it is totally the biggest lie and the biggest propaganda to discredit his ministry that I have ever seen. And he's misquoted and misunderstood and, you know, all of these things, and yet he never says a word. He never writes anything. He never writes these people other than to say, you know, I'm sorry that you feel the way you do, but have you ever asked me what I believe? I think if you would, I think you'd find that these things are not true, what they're saying, or whatever it is. But he has been very... I have never seen him react. We had an elders meeting the other day, and it was a retreat. And so John walks in, and the elders decided it was Jump on John Day. And so they unloaded their trucks on him. He never said a word. Never responded. He says, well, is there anything, you know, would you like for me to leave so you could finish this? No, John, we want you to stay. We want you to hear it all. And he never said a word the whole time, sir. Tremendous response. And some of it was justified, some of it wasn't, but he never tried to justify anything he did. And I think that is a key element for all of us. You're going to be criticized. Now the issue is how you handle that criticism. Accept it for fact that you will be criticized. Now the issue is how are you going to respond to it? Well, obviously you say, boy, thanks. I'll really take that into consideration. I never really thought that area in my life, and I appreciate it, and I'm going to do something about that. Thank you. So often, though, we want to, you know, wait a minute. You know, that's not really me. You know, we try to, in some ways, react, you know, maybe out of defense. Justify that, well, maybe it was not as bad as you think. This is really what I was trying to say or whatever. I think we just have to realize that there are exceptions where we need to say something or whatever, but let's be very careful that when we do receive criticism, that we see the example of Christ and how He handled criticism, and maybe the less we say, the better it is. Well, you know, the reason they're saying that is because that's in their perception, that's the way it is. See, the problem with that, if they perceive it, then in their mind it's true, whether it's true or not. And so, you know, the way I've seen it is that if they perceive that in me, then that's they see it as true, and so that's something I need to work on, if that's their perception of me. Yeah, but are they going to respond if you try to help correct them in their understanding of who you are and why you did what you did? Have you done that in the past? And has it worked out very satisfactorily? And again, I'm sure that you handle it, you know, correctly. But I just think that as a general principle for all of us, be careful how we respond to criticism. Realizing we're going to receive it, and then the issue is just how are we going to react to it or respond to it when it does come. And it may be that we'll need to set the record straight or say whatever we need to say to help them understand that. What I have found that when I've tried to justify myself, it's only made it worse. Rather than just say, "Well, I appreciate what you're saying. I'll sure evaluate that. I appreciate your concerns about me." Normally, they don't come to you though. See, that's if they would, then that's the obvious way to deal with it. But normally, it's behind the back. You say, "Well, how come he didn't come to me? You know, why did you tell so and so?" Well, I think you should probably go to that person. Now, see, here's what's wrong, is the other person should have said, wait a minute, don't tell me another thing. Don't tell this to me. If you have a problem with Pastor, you go to him. I don't want to hear it. See, so he was wrong in listening to it in the first place. So now you got two people that are wrong that, in a sense, you need to deal with. Say, well, Joe, you know, I appreciate you sharing that with me, but, you know, biblically, you know, you should have stopped them because you're entertaining gossip at this point, or criticism, or whatever it is. You should have told them to come to me and not entertain what they're saying. I appreciate you telling me that, but in the future, if somebody does that to you, whether it's me or somebody else, you stop them before they get into it and say, don't talk to me, you need to talk to the pastor or whoever it is you have a problem with. And then you go to the other person and say, you know, go through the same steps. And say, I understand that you have some issues that you needed to deal with me. I wish you would have come to me and not involve so-and-so because now there's another person involved in this. And biblically there should be only two. And so maybe it's a time for teaching And you say, now that you did a little teaching, you say, okay, now let's, you know, what are the issues that you have concern in my life or in my ministry or whatever? Again, try to be as humble and as accepting as possible. You know, what can they say if you accept it? They have nothing to come back with you on, right? If you accept everything they say, well, yes, I appreciate that. Boy, you know, that's a good insight, or that's or whatever. And you never try to justify or to give them reasons why, so that there's no rebuttal, then they can't say another word. You know, it's done. It's over. And so I think so often that's the way we need to handle it. Accept it as their perceptions and try to deal with it. If they're thinking that, maybe somebody else is thinking that too. If we're perceived in a certain way, then so often, see, we see ourselves one way, but a lot of other people see it a different way. And if that perception is there, maybe we need to deal with it. See it as reality, at least as reality in their thinking, and then begin to deal with it. Give me an example of something like, Pastor, well, the thing I should have talked to you and I didn't, you're not personable enough. You don't seem warm. You always seem to be preoccupied with something else. Well, thank you. I really didn't notice that in my life, but if that seems to be an issue, I'll work on that. I really appreciate that. What could they say if you agree that may be an area that you need to work on? If that's what their perception is. Okay, what do you give me something? Give me an far out instance, the most absurd thing you can think of. Okay, accused of stealing money from the church. Well, I could see why you might think that of the fact that I took the money home, you know, and counted it. You know, I know that there's some men. Some pastors that are doing the same thing that you're talking about your treasure. That's a good. See, the problem is if you put yourself in that position, then what can you say?
Especially if you let yourself out, you can only say, "I'm sorry, you're right, though I know I am."
Yeah.
It is appropriate for me to let you know that I can't control whether you believe me or not,
right.
But you need to know before the Lord that this is where I stand.
Yeah.
In other words, it seems to be valid to not to accept what it says, to deny where it is inaccurate and let it rest. The denial, in my view, is valid.
Right.
The debating and getting into arguing and self-education that I think starts to become.
You know, those things are not very, those are the real exceptions. Most of the criticism is very petty kinds of things, right? That's really. We were dealing with a missionary he was a national down in Sri Lanka. There are all these accusations against him that we couldn't prove one way or the other. All right? And One of he was working for Christian Nationals, CNEC. I don't know if you have that group here. All right, they sent their man down there, and the guy says, "I was ready to support him totally on this because none of it could be verified until the guy started trying to defend himself and to impugn all the other people and all the other witnesses that had been brought forth to speak out against him. Once he started that tirade in trying to tear down them and justify himself, the guy said, you know, I knew that he was guilty. Now, or I knew that he was not somebody that we needed and wanted to support. All right? And so there was an issue where a guy tried to vindicate himself and tried to justify himself and tried to discredit all of the witnesses, and it cost him his support from us as well as other groups in America. Now, first of all, you know, when it comes to these kinds of things, make sure you don't put yourself in a position to be accused of theft or of immorality. You know, don't ever counsel anybody of the opposite sex, you know, behind closed doors or after hours. You're the only ones in the church because, see, it doesn't matter whether anything happened. If she says it does, guess who they're going to believe? Not you, you know. Not with all the things that are going on around the world right now. And so you want to make sure that you don't put yourself in those kinds of situations so that if something happens and she starts causing a rumor, you know, you don't have to say a word because you've never been in a situation where anybody could say anything that you've done that sort of thing. I'm not sure we've settled that. Yeah. Well, you might, you know, some of these situations say, well, you know, that's not something that I'm, you know, that I've done. And I'm sorry that you feel that I've done that. But I don't know how to deal with those kinds. I'm just thinking that the majority of the kinds of things that we deal with that are the petty kinds of criticism that I'm really talking about are the things that in many cases we try to defend ourselves or try to justify rather than just humbly accepting it and going on. Okay.
Just an example quickly on that. What often happens is pastors get caught in a particular area where there's a grain of truth that's been built so that what we did was not wrong. But how to find it totally puts up in a bad light. Now, I got caught in a whole series of these with the group who had just left my church, and I tried to tell the truth about them. They would simply take my explanation, twist those, and make it look even worse. I thank God that early in the piece, my wife said, Alan, don't say a word. Don't you defend yourself. She said, then they can keep on saying the same thing over and over again, and just get bored of hearing those criticisms. She said, if you defend yourself and say what you feel, you know, the truth is, if you do that, they've got something else new.
Mm-hmm.
They attack. But when I did that, I just, you know, the thing keeps on feeding back. And eventually, they just kept on saying the same thing, and they were almost discrediting themselves and just sort of saying the same thing, saying the same thing.
Yeah. They're great to have around, aren't they? They sure give us a lot of advice. I think what happens is the normal reaction is to defend ourselves, isn't it? All right? And if that's the normal reaction, then we probably see that's not of the Lord, that's of the flesh. And so the best thing to do, at least for some period of time, maybe to keep quiet. And then maybe at some point in time, we will need to say something, but maybe not at that first outburst when they come in and accuse us or we hear of a criticism. Don't go out and immediately try to justify ourselves. find out what the issues are and find out what needs to be done, and then maybe pray about it, and over a period of time, maybe you need to say something, and then maybe not, depending on how the situation goes. Okay? So, I think we all realize that criticizing will be a big part of that. Boy, we'll move through these very quickly because it's getting to be supper time. Not supper time, dinner time? Dinner time. Tea time, right. Supper's later. It will involve rejection. What did Jesus say? He came to His own and His own received Him not. No man is ever fully accepted until he has first of all been fully rejected. And I don't know how to take that. I'm not even sure where I got that quote. It sounded great when I put it down. And something like that, you probably should, you know, say it and then move on. And people say, "Wow, that was deep." No man is ever fully accepted until at first of all he's been fully rejected. Okay? We'll let you think on that one a while. I like this one. Often the crowd does not recognize the leader until he has gone, and then they build a monument for him with the stones they threw at him in life. Right? And unfortunately, that's what happens with most of us, that there's probably none of us who have not been rejected at some time in our life and in our ministry. And the way I look at it and the way I try to tell the seminary students is, don't take rejection personally. It's a lot more healthy that way, for one thing. And in many cases, they're not rejecting you. They're rejecting the principles that you're trying to set forth in the Word of God. In a sense, what they're doing is reacting to God and His working in their lives. And so they're having this battle with God, and you happen to be in the middle. And so they reject you because you're God's mouthpiece. And so don't take it personally. They're not after you. They're really after God. You just happen to be standing in the middle. And I think that makes it a lot more healthy so that you don't have to start questioning your own abilities and your own gifts and your own personhood because, you know, well, they reject me. No, they're rejecting the message that you're giving from God. Now, I would also have to say that we need to ask ourselves, now, am I causing the rejection? Is it me they're rejecting because of some of the ways I've given them these things, the way I am coming across to them, or is it the message that they're rejecting? So you need to evaluate that and evaluate for the possibility that maybe you are alienating in some ways, your personality or the way you come across or whatever. But be very careful that you don't personally take these kinds of things. If you've got thin skin, then you probably won't last too long in the ministry, right? Thick-skinned, not take things personally. Don't try to defend yourself with all the criticism that you get. So all of these things kind of add up to be, you know, it's going to cost a lot to be in the ministry. It almost, you may ask yourself the question, why in the world am I in the ministry at all if it's all of this? And yet that's the way it is. It may lead to pride. 1 Timothy 3:6 talks about not putting men into positions of leadership too quickly, and not having new people or people who are new in the faith, and not a new convert, lest he become conceited and fall into the condemnation incurred by the devil. You see, the condemnation incurred by the devil was one of pride, wasn't it? And so often that we can receive a lot of pride. Nothing personal for our doctor friends up in the bleachers, but when I was in pharmaceutical sales, I would call on all these doctors, and particularly the last one I had was in Beverly Hills. And you know, doctors, after a while, you know, they were receiving all of these accolades. If everybody that came into your office said, "Boy, doctor, thank you. You saved my life. You saved my daughter's life. You saved my son's life. You are so great. I thank you." After a while, you began to start thinking, you know, maybe I'm a pretty good doctor. And what I found out, present company accepted, that these guys had this tremendous ego that they had developed over the years because of all the people, the things that people were saying about them. And I think the same thing happens in the ministry. After a while, and after the people telling you what a great job you're doing, and maybe this doesn't happen to you, but there are a lot of times when people say, "Boy, you know, Pastor, you really ministered to me. That, you know, the service that you conducted from, you know, my mother's funeral, it really meant a lot to me, and I really appreciate this." And on it goes, to the point where after a while, you begin to think yourself to be a pretty special guy. God's gift to the world. And so it can lead to pride. Yeah. Yeah. Right. You know, the fact that a man has risen to a position of leadership with its prominence tends to increase the chances of pride developing. And if left unchecked, could render us useless. You know, Ezekiel 28 and Isaiah 14, talking about, you know, the pride of the devil, you know, thought himself to be more than what he was. Proverbs 16:5 says that pride is the abomination of the Lord. King Uzziah in 2 Chronicles 26, you know, because of his pride, took up a censer and went into the temple, and he was given leprosy to his death because he was so proud that he thought he was something special. Pride will destroy a leader faster than anything else. You know why? Because pride and God cannot both occupy the same place at the same time. And so, if you're proud, then God cannot occupy that portion of your life because of your pride. And so that is the most devastating thing of all, and the thing that will so quickly bring you down. Because you and your pride and God cannot occupy the same place. We must see ourselves as servants. Do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit. Philippians chapter 2. So I think that's the idea. If we're constantly seeing the ministry as a ministry of service or servitude, then that'll help check our pride. See yourself as constantly in the service of others. And that you are stewards of the manifold mysteries of God, and that you are God's steward. Those are God's sheep, not yours. It's His church, not yours. And so therefore, you are to be accountable for that, and you are an under-shepherd, not the shepherd. And that'll keep you in that state of humility. And when all else fails, God also provides a few of your congregation to keep you humble. And if that fails, He also gives you your wife, and she'll keep you humble as well. So, those are all ways. It may lead to ambition. And the thing about this one is, now, in 1 Timothy 3, it talks about this idea: if any man aspires to the office of an overseer, is a fine work he desires to do. The issue there is ambition for the work, not for the office or the position. If we are looking for status, if we're looking at prominence, then that is the wrong motive for ambition. And it is ambition. Ambition is a corollary to pride, but not necessarily so. As we see in 1 Timothy 3, ambition is not wrong, but it depends upon the object of that ambition. ambition that has as its center the glory of God and the welfare of His church is legitimate and of the highest form. So the fact that you want to serve God and be all that God wants you to be and all that you can be, I think is a noble task. We just need to make sure that it's ambition for the right reason. All right? Not for our own glory, but for the glory of God and His church. You know? Popularity, lordship, power, money, promotion are for the wrong motives. For us as leaders. Moses had his motives tested in Numbers 14:12. Remember in 14:12 what he was asked to do? God says, Moses, stand back. I'm going to destroy those people. They're stiff-necked. They've always been disobedient ever since we were in Egypt. I'm going to destroy them, and I'm going to make a great nation out of you. Boy, how would you respond to that? Well, Lord, if you must, you must. But what did he do? He fell on his face and says, God, you cannot do that. You know, you promised that you would deliver these people, that you would securely take them securely into the new land, and your honor is at stake here. You can't do that. So here was a man whose ambition was tested, and he came through, didn't he? And I think God tests our motives for ministry as well at times. Okay, finally, it may lead to failure. Matthew 26:69-75. Was that one? Jeremiah 45:5. Did somebody look that up? Yeah. Now, the issue with that can be taken out of context. Okay? But you, are you seeking great things for yourself? Do not seek them, for behold, I am going to bring a disaster on all flesh. The idea there, seeking great things for yourself. Again, I think it's the object of our ambition. Is it for ourselves? Is it for the glory of God? Finally, it may lead to failure. Matthew 26. That was the Apostle Peter, wasn't it? Denied the Lord all those times. Is a prime example of one who failed, but who kept coming back. John Mark in Acts 13 failed, didn't he? But yet in 2 Timothy 4:11, Paul says, bring John Mark with you because he's useful for service. Here's a man who was reclaimed. So Apostle Peter, John Mark, both of these men failed, but God ultimately used them. So failure is not the end of it, is it? It's a part of the process that God uses in our lives. Abraham Lincoln is a secular example of a man who failed. It's incredible the number of times that he failed throughout his life, and yet he ended up being the President of the United States. What does that say about our presidency? But the issue there is the fact that he didn't give up. He didn't let failure defeat him. And I think that that's the way it is with us in the ministry. We're going to have failures, but we mustn't let those failures defeat us from our service to God. Maybe it's God's way of tempering us, His way of dealing with pride in our lives, any number of issues. The worth of a man must be measured by his life, not by his failure under a singular or particular trial. So your life is not going to be measured by the singular or particular failures in your life, but by your entire life, the breadth of it. Not by one episode within that life, but by the entirety of that life. So we mustn't see a failure as the end. We see it as a time that we regroup, that, you know, depending on what the failure was, we evaluate that and then go on. The successful leader is a man who has learned that no failure need to be final and acts on that belief whether the failure is his own or that of another. That's the other side of it. We talk about failure in our own life, but what about the failure in another man's life? Are we the kind of leaders that once a man has failed, that's it, he's out, no more chances? You know, if we see that God has given us so many chances, we fail the Lord so many times, and yet He continually gives us opportunities to serve Him, then we have to be very careful about those that work with us, that when they fail. So often, I hear people say, "Well, Joe, how about him for a leader?" Nope, I remember back in 36. You know, and they remember so far back in time about something he did 20 years ago that now they're saying, "We'll keep him disqualified." Hopefully in 20 years he's grown a little bit in some of those areas. And, you know, if he's still got the same problem he had 20 years ago, yes, he's still disqualified, but hopefully he's worked through that and now he can be used in service to God. He must learn to be realistic and accept the fact that we all make mistakes. We must have the freedom to fail and allow others the same freedom. So this area of failure is an element that we must realize in the cost of leadership. Now, there are certain times, and we'll talk about this probably again, but we have to ask ourselves the question is, when is failure the end? And what failure, what issue makes our ministry no longer valid? I think as Ron talked about it this morning with certain kinds of failures, that it is disqualification permanently from the ministry. I think we have to be very careful by not too quickly putting people back into the ministry. I think this whole thing with Jimmy Swaggart was an abomination. I think the thing with Gordon McDonald was also something that is highly questionable in the sense that he has now been restored after a year. In fact, he never was totally out of the ministry. He still was involved in speaking engagements throughout this last year against the wishes of those men who were supposedly his mentors, his counselors this last year. I know John had talked, the guy who is the pastor of the church called him up and told him this is what we were going to do, and he wanted to get John's reaction to what they were going to do. And I think that according to what John said, he felt it was a very grave decision they made, because that sets a standard for the evangelical community. You know, the charismatics can do what they want, and we all write that off as, you know, wild-eyed charismatics doing, you know, letting their people do whatever they want to do. You know, come back after a few months or slap a person's hand and he's back in the ministry in a short period of time. We think that's terrible. But what about our own situation? Gordon McDonald is one of our favorite sons, and now after a year of probation, he's back in the ministry. After several years of being involved in this kind of a situation, and then being caught, you know, and having to him being exposed, not even exposing himself, but having been exposed by others. How long does it take, or how long should it take, or should it be something that we see the ministry as such a high calling and the responsibility so weighty that something like this should be considered so grave that we, if we fall into that kind of temptation and sin, that we ourselves see ourselves out of the ministry seen as one who as an example and a leader for God's people anymore. We can still minister in the church, we can still function as a Christian, but that position of leader, boy, you know, it should be such a high calling and such a standard that I'm afraid these men who are being reestablished in the ministry have definitely lowered it a notch by being reinstalled in the ministry. Again, that's my own feeling on that, and I also hold the same view that John does on that. And it's a hard line, but it depends on, you know, how we see the ministry, how we see this position that God has put us in. If a guy can take a few months off, get his hands spanked, and be right back in it, then it's sure not going to be a real deterrent for more people not being involved in that.